The miraculous transformations of fermentation.
During the fermentation process, while it's happening, you can actually watch it transform. You can watch it come to life because, like, the gases show that it has a breath. And then, you know, the acids bring this tremendous flavor forth.
That's Tara Whitsitt. We talk with her about her book, Fermentation on Wheels. It's a story of how she's been spreading the word about the wonders of fermented foods by traveling around the country on a bus. Then we re-air our interview with Catherine Harvey about her book, The Bare Bones Broth Cookbook. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. Legend says that Johnny Appleseed spread the cultivation of apples around the nation. You could say Tara Whitsitt is a modern-day Johnny Appleseed, only what she's spreading is a cultivation of a whole array of fermented foods. Foods like sauerkraut and kimchi, kombucha and tibikos, miso and vinegars, and much, much more. Whitsitt travels around the country on a converted school bus that is both dwelling and fermentation lab, library, and workshop. I first encountered Whitsitt in New York City when I took one of her workshops about making kombucha, one of the easiest fermented drinks to make. Now she's out with a terrific book, Fermentation on Wheels. It's part memoir, part how-to, with loads of great recipes. It's all part of Whitsitt's mission to bring fermentation education to communities of all ages and backgrounds. Well, Tara Whitsitt, welcome to Writer's Voice. This book, Fermentation on Wheels, is just a wonderful book. It's a story of how you've gone on a bus all around the country teaching people about fermentation. First, tell us what happens with fermentation.
So, with fermentation, sugars are consumed via microorganisms or microbes and converted into acids and gases. And those acids and gases, in the process, we get more microbial life. So in turn, through fermentation, we are getting super rich, flavorful, lifelike foods. And even during the fermentation process, while it's happening, you can actually watch it transform. You can watch it come to life because, like, the gases show that it has a breath. And then, you know, the acids bring this tremendous flavor forth. So it's like with cheese, for example. There are all these different levels of cheese and funky flavors that cheese presents, and cheese comes from milk. So let's say, you know, starting with yogurt, yogurt's a very basic one day or less fermentation, and it has a mild flavor, but you can ferment yogurt longer, take that to another level and make some yogurt cheese, and it gets stronger, and it, as it ages, it gets harder and the flavor richer. And so fermentation has all these different steps of transformation that bring really fascinating, lovely flavors. And it's also visually mesmerizing, the entire process. So
visually mesmerizing?
Yes, because like I mentioned, you can watch the breath, right? Like, because there's CO2 coming forth, like there are gases produced in this process too. So you can actually watch it transform, not just through that breath, through the movement of bubbles going through the, you know, bubbles are in vegetable fermentation. With yogurt, you know, you watch it slowly, like, take form, take shape, and harden, or, you know, it doesn't harden necessarily, but it definitely forms more of a mold. And then, you know, color-wise, too, like, colors change when we ferment. It's a very visual process, and that's something I really, really love about it, too.
I think our listeners can already tell just how rich an experience you really have, and you communicate about fermentation in this book. You know, you really experiment with all kinds of things, and you have some amazing recipes. Let's first, though, talk about how did you get into this to begin with?
I first got into fermentation through my first batch of sauerkraut. I was living in Brooklyn, and someone taught me how to make sauerkraut. And from that moment forth, it was kind of revelatory. It was like, oh, wow, I'm growing an ecosystem in a jar. And I think at that moment, because I had lived such an urban existence, I realized how disconnected I had been from life, living forces, hidden life forces, for one, in fermentation, but then also just like the natural world. I grew up in Houston. I moved to Philadelphia and then New York City. At least those are the cities I spent the bulk of my youth and early 20s in. And I was like, after fermentation, I was like, wow, there's so much life in food. Like, there's so much more to this. And I have been completely disconnected from what that means and how my body, how the life inside me, how my ecosystem, like what it looks like when I'm in synergy with other ecosystems, like the ones I'm consuming or the ones that I'm working with to make something really nourishing. And so with that, it translated to what it might look like to get in the garden and grow my own food, or to walk in the forest and forage my own food. So that led me on a whole other journey to seek out the soil to plant to food process. And that led me to Oregon, which is where I eventually came up with the idea for fermentation on wheels.
And it came to you in a dream.
It did. It did. And I had been very interested in fermentation from the start of moving to Oregon, and that was what I was pursuing when I left New York. I wasn't sure what that looked like, but it was definitely always on my mind, consciously, subconsciously, coming to me in my dreams. And so, yeah, those dreams, I had three dreams, a series of dreams about driving around in a school bus and sharing my wares with many a person. It really spoke to me.
And you have become a kind of Johnny Appleseed of fermentation, really spreading the gospel of fermentation, although maybe gospel is not so much the right word as well, you talk about fermentation as being a political statement. I wonder if you could say more about how fermentation fits into your politics. What do you mean by a political statement?
Fermentation is a very sustainable food process, and I think it also really highlights the importance of trusting our instincts and like that intuitive part of food, like what is already in us, what we already know, like being connected, which is, you know, it goes back to what I mentioned earlier about having lived such an urban existence and realizing how disconnected I was. And I think that goes hand in hand with politically too. I think politically we are very disconnected, and that community and instinct and really like living based on what feels right, and you know, having a more optimistic view, going with your gut rather than feeling bogged down by how people say you should be living, which I think dominates a lot of people's lives now. Like, there are a lot of norms that we believe we have to follow, and a lot of those norms are created by people in political places, you know, guided by capitalism and lies, and it's all, you know, marketing and consume, consume, consume. And so with fermentation, it's like you have many parts that come together to create something much greater. And it, I think it really shows the power of not only community, but what it means to be connected to our senses and what feels good, what feels right. You know, it's almost like being in that mother state where you're simply just working on like intuition. It's like when you have a child and you're watching something grow and you have to take care of it. You don't go by like, I mean, usually you wouldn't go by norms or what, you know, what society is telling you you have to do. You go by what feels right, you know, like what you're sensing as that child's mother. And I feel like fermentation holds a lot of that too. And I think it goes into looking at microorganisms. They are this underlying force that connects all living things. And I think realizing that we are just part of this huge organism of life, and we are related to so much that is on the earth that we neglect. I think that, you know, there are a lot of answers there. We're kind of like, we're going backwards rather than forwards with the technologies we're starting to trust.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking about fermentation. My guest is Tara Whitsett, and her book is Fermentation on Wheels. You know, when you talk about being connected to the community of life, I mean, there's the macrobiome and then the microbiome. I mean, fermentation, so many people are getting into it because we are beginning to recognize that we have far more microbes in our body than we have maybe what we might call human DNA. So talk a little bit about what are some of the ways in which fermentation is basically good for us.
Yeah. Fermentation is extremely beneficial for our innards in many different ways. And I think that like a lot of research has highlighted that in the past decade, especially. It's good for our mental health, good for digestion. It's been shown that having a robust, well-populated gut or microbiome is at least having a better immune system. And so you feel better when you're taking care of this part of your body. And like the gut is like a second brain. That's what is being said these days. It's really important for health. And so the reason that people are so interested in fermentation, I've found over the last 3 years, I guess like the audience has been changing a lot, and changing in a really good way because people are becoming more aware of their microbiomes and how that improves their health. So, and the reason why we're becoming so aware is because processed foods have become the norm in our eating habits. We have millions of miles of corn in Iowa alone, and all of these crops are GMO grown and or sprayed with pesticides. And, you know, that corn, I mean, a lot of it is turned into ethanol. A lot of it is fed to animals in feedlots. There's a lot of toxicity involved. And just being in a toxic environment can, you know, impact you negatively. And if you have a weak immune system from having access to only processed foods, you suffer a lot. And so I found that when I was traveling through the Midwest, people were really, really craving these foods and really, really curious about how it could help improve their immune system because they had been suffering from a lot of chemical residue in the air. And a lot of people I met also were survivors of stuff that, either from being around these chemicals or just, you know, having a really wretched diet, a diet that wasn't nourishing them. And these people I met on the road, a lot of them were able to heal themselves through a more natural plant-based diet, and also by integrating living foods into their diets, which includes fermented foods, right? So, I mean, fermented foods are a huge part of foods that can be consumed. I mean, they're much more common than people think. I mean, I often meet people who are like, oh yeah, fermented foods, I don't eat those. I'm like, really? Are you sure? Because if you were to tell me everything you eat, I'm sure that I could point out that quite a few of them are fermented. They might not be buying the fermented version of that food. They might be getting pasteurized Yoplait yogurt, but you know, it could be a life-changing experience to eat some living yogurt for them. So yeah, I mean, that's part of what this is about too, getting out in the world and, you know, talking to people about what can nourish them.
Yeah, and I mean, if people eat cheese, they're eating fermented food, and if they drink beer, they're drinking fermented food.
Yeah, totally, yeah, and that's, you know, that's a big one when people are like, I don't like anything fermented. I'm like, well, you know, you're holding a beer. So, that's fermented. Yeah.
So let's talk about some of those fermented foods. First of all, in the book, you talk about wild fermentation. There's fermentation where you use inoculants. I mean, for example, I make my own yogurt and I use either yogurt I've made or, you know, good grass-fed organic yogurt that I buy from the store to inoculate it. But then there's like sourdough bread, which you can have an inoculant, but you can also ferment it wild. So what is the difference in, what's the difference in quality, if any?
So wild fermentation, it's, I guess, a term coined by Sander Katz based on his book, Wild Fermentation, which really started the revival of fermented foods, which was published a little over a decade ago. And so wild fermentation, by the way, that's a great book, and I recommend it to anyone who's looking to get into fermentation. But wild fermentation refers to the random occurrence of local microflora working to ferment foods without the addition of any bacteria and yeast. So that microflora is bacteria and yeast, and it's already living on the food. Bacteria and yeast are everywhere. And if we buy a fresh quart of raw milk, for example, which can be really hard to find in most states, but unpasteurized, so it hasn't been heated, when we get milk fresh from the animal, it has life in it. There are actual microflora. And when you let that milk sit, it ferments on its own. And you can make really lovely cheeses from that just on its own. You don't have to add anything. Sauerkraut is very often made through the process of wild fermentation. So there is enough life on and in plant material. So not just cabbage, but radishes, turnips, turmeric, ginger, plants, they have so much life on their own. And we can simply provide some conditions for that life to proliferate, for fermentation to really take hold and let it, you know, take on a life of its own and take on flavors of its own. So those are also examples of wild fermentation. And then with fermentation through inoculation, you would actually add starter culture or bacteria and yeast of some form to get the process going. So good examples of that, like you said, there's yogurt, sourdough. You want to make a sourdough starter, which you can do from scratch. You make it wildly, and then you inoculate your flour and dough. It's what you would use instead of commercial yeast to get that process going, to get a rise. Like I said, you know, acids and gases come forth in fermentation. Bread is a very visual, perfect example of that. You know, you get to actually watch that bread puff up into, the shape that you want, the size that you want before you put it in the oven. So yeah, kombucha is a good example. With kombucha, you actually use a SCOBY, which is a disc-shaped, they call them mothers or SCOBYs. And SCOBYs can refer to many different starter cultures. Just it stands for a symbiotic colony of bacteria and yeast. So that SCOBY is a starter culture, and you use it to inoculate sweet tea. And that sweet tea is used with a Camellia sinensis strain of tea. So you would use black tea or green tea, something that has caffeine. It's from that family of teas. Those are just a few examples, but there are so many examples of starter cultures you can use to get the fermentation process going. And the reason why we might want to use a starter culture is because it would be very difficult to make that flavor wildly, or just even get the process started wildly. Like yogurt, for example, there are many different kinds of yogurt. So even if you had raw milk, yeah, you could make a wild yogurt. You could let it sit, but it's not really going to sit like yogurt. It's going to curdle, and you're going to get curds and whey, and it's going to be better suited for cheese. And even then, the cheese, it's going to be a little unpredictable. And that's how wild fermentation is. It's a little unpredictable. Whereas when you work with a starter culture and you inoculate these foods, you're going to get something that you can predict. And that's why you use a starter culture usually. It's like you have your baby starter culture, you feed it, and you know, when you want that specific brew or that specific yogurt, then you inoculate and it comes forth. So that's the main difference. And I wouldn't say there's a huge flavor difference. I mean, there are so many variables, and like with fermented vegetables, which are almost always fermented wildly, you can always get some really fantastic flavors as long as you've got the conditions that you need for fermentation to occur, and you're working with ingredients that are, you know, more or less prime.
I have tried my hand with making kimchi and sauerkraut, and I have to say I failed miserably every time except the first time. My Japanese daughter-in-law loved my first kimchi, and I have no idea what I did because I haven't been able to do it again. One problem I find is that the recipes that I've gotten on the web, and I haven't yet tried yours, call for adding so much salt, and then whatever I'm making is just way too salty. How does one deal with that?
So salt is another example of intuitive processes in food and in fermentation. I think sometimes people think, oh, fermentation is this very scientific method. Like I need the amounts of everything to be just right. And that's actually not true. I mean, it is a scientific process. There is science happening. However, with salt, you can really, I mean, when it comes to salting vegetables, there are different salinity percentages that you can use in fermentation, different ratios. And I generally like less salt. Some people like a little more salt. And so what I say is use 1 tablespoon of salt per 2 to 3 pounds of veggies. I know not everyone's going to be weighing their veggies, but this is another thing that I emphasize in my book, is that, you know, start with a tablespoon and massage the salt in, and then taste as you go. Just like you would in any kitchen practice, like you taste the things as you go. If it's too salty before you pack it in the jar, it's going to be too salty when it's finished. You're not going to like it when it's finished. And you know, that's something really important to pay attention to. I mean, the salt has several functions. I mean, for one, it promotes the growth of lactobacillus, which is bacteria we want to promote in the fermentation process, and it also keeps undesirable bacteria at bay. Lactobacillus is a halophile, in other words, a salt-loving organism. But then also we use salt to promote a brine. So when we massage vegetables with salt, they sweat. We get the juices from those veggies. And then with that sweat, we are actually, it's a brine. And we're able to pack the veggies below the brine. So we have an anaerobic environment, which is another condition we need in fermentation, in vegetable fermentation. And then last of all, salt functions as a flavoring agent. That means you also want to salt to taste. You don't just throw any old amount of salt in there and say, okay, it's good. You salt it. I like to salt in layers. I'll put like a teaspoon of salt between every quarter piece of cabbage I cut, and I'll just keep massaging it. And then I'll taste it at the end. And if I'm like, oh, it's a little on the light side, I'll just add a little more salt and get it until it's just right for me. It's very rare that at a workshop I've salted cabbage and we do the tasting in the class of the cabbage pieces. It's very rare that people will say that everyone, or that there will be a lot of varying opinions, like, oh, that's way too much salt, and the other person, like, that's way too little salt. Like, we are more or less, as human beings, we have a pretty similar taste for salt.
So we've talked about yogurt and sauerkraut and kimchi, but there are so many other recipes in this wonderful book, Tara Witsit, this book, Fermentation on Wheels, Road Stories, Food Ramblings, and 50 Do-It-Yourself Recipes from Sauerkraut, Kombucha, and Yogurt to Miso, Tempeh, and Mead. Talking about the fermented drinks, you have some that I'd never heard of before. For example, Tibicos?
Tibicos, yeah, water kefir. So the Tibicos that I write about in my book, I got it from Arizona, and it was harvested from a cactus that was native to the area, an Apuntia cactus. And it's a lovely culture. It's used to make sodas, usually, and it's just sugar water or juice. And in 24 to 48 hours, you'll have a fizzy beverage, a fermented soda, if you will. And yeah, it's a high maintenance beverage because it ferments quite fast, especially compared to like kombucha, which I think a lot of people who are experimenting more with fermented beverages these days, it's more or less, it's usually kombucha because it's more popular, more known. But water kefir is really fun if you want to have something testing your skills for maintaining food. I mean, it's really, it requires a lot of attention, but it is tasty.
You tell a story in the book about a cheese expert, a nun who had to switch to a stainless steel vat instead of the wooden barrel that she had been using because the FDA made her do that. And then she did an experiment. Tell us about her. Tell us why the FDA came in, and what did she find?
Yeah, so Noella, I think it's Marcellina, more known as the Cheese Nun. There was a documentary made on her called The Cheese Nun. She is a nun and a microbiologist and a cheesemaker, and she... The FDA wanted her to switch to a stainless steel fermentation container, and she had used a wooden container of all of her cheesemaking career life. And so she's like, oh, I'm going to show them, you know, that this is actually a better way to ferment the cheese. And the reason that they wanted her to use stainless steel is because they thought it was more sanitary. And, you know, there's been like a war on bacteria ever since the Industrial Revolution. It's like just been one of those things like stamp out diversity and, you know, let's make sure no one gets sick from eating bacteria. It's, you know, it's just been this weird thing that's been stamped into our brains, and the FDA is really, they're still really, really on that. And they're still running that, and there's a lot of education to be done for them still. And Noella, she's been one of those educators. And so what she did was she fermented a batch of cheese in a stainless steel container and a batch of cheese in her wooden barrel and inoculated them both with E. coli. And the stainless steel batch was no good, whereas the batch in the wooden barrel, it was fine because it was lined with years of lactobacillus growth from all of her cheese making in the past. And that shows, you know, that shows the resiliency of lactobacillus, which is a primary bacteria that we work with in nearly all fermented food. So, you know, that just, it goes to show a lot more than just about cheese and teaching regulatory agencies about why this process is safe. It really shows that this life form is something that, you know, if we work with it, and we help increase its resilience by feeding it and nurturing it, that it can protect us too.
Tara Witsit. We'll talk more with her about fermentation and how to do it after the break. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with Tara Witsit about fermentation, how it works, and how to make a variety of delicious and nutritious fermented foods. Her book is Fermentation on Wheels, Road Stories, Food Ramblings, and 50 Do-It-Yourself Recipes.
Now, many times people who get into fermentation, well, I mean, you said it before, it's you're like a mother. You have to take care of these cultures, and that can be difficult. I mean, one reason I don't try to do a sourdough culture is because I'm traveling around and doing different things, and then I'm afraid that I can't leave it alone. So what's your advice to people who would like to get into fermentation, but maybe not to the depth of a true fanatic?
You know, I think fanaticism just comes with like getting your feet wet and like dipping your feet in the water. It's not like it's not a given, but once you start doing it, it's pretty addictive. And once you start having success with it, it's really addictive. And I mean, the main thing with fermentation, it's about building a routine. So I think the most important thing to consider is like what kind of a food routine works for you. So sauerkraut, it ferments in roughly 3 to 4 weeks. At least that's my preference. Some people like sauerkraut after 2 weeks. And it's going to vary based on where you live too, because it's a temperature thing. The warmer it is, the faster it ferments, and the colder it is, the slower fermentation occurs. But, you know, that's something you'll want to think about, because if you, you know, if you love sauerkraut and you want to have a lot, think about how often you're going to have to practice that routine in the kitchen and how much you'll want to make at a time. Like how much sauerkraut do you eat in a 2 week period or 3 or 4 week period? And then, you know, like water kefir, that's very high maintenance. I wouldn't recommend it for beginners. Kombucha, I know a lot of people who have gotten into fermentation through kombucha. It's a really good gateway. I mean, kombucha takes a week or two to ferment. And then there's miso. Miso takes 1 year to ferment. And it's like a half day in the kitchen to make a batch of miso. And then a year later, you can enjoy that miso throughout the entire year. And, you know, when you unpack the miso from a year before, make another batch, and then you have your yearly miso. I mean, that's a really great routine to practice as well. But as far as how to get into fermentation, I feel like all of these foods are so accessible for people. And because it is intuitive, I mean, it is trusting your senses. And, you know, I feel like you should go with what you enjoy most. Like if you're a big miso fan, then make some miso. It's not too hard to make. If you love sauerkraut, definitely make sauerkraut. Sauerkraut's so easy. It's just massaging cabbage with salt every 3 to 4 weeks. I mean, it's like, it's actually very therapeutic. It's a very nice routine. I really covet my cabbage massages, and I make about 2 gallons every 1 to 2 weeks. I mean, I feed a lot of people, but I'm also eating a lot myself. So yeah, dairy kefir is really easy. And if you're a fan of dairy, but maybe lactose is hard on you, then lactose is the milk sugar that's fermented in dairy fermentation. So kefir, yogurt, cheese, your body will tolerate them a little more. I mean, it depends on your, you know, your level of intolerance, but kefir is so easy and it's so delicious, and it takes a few days to make, and it lasts for about a week in the fridge, sometimes out of the fridge, depending on the time of year. And it's super nourishing, and you can make lovely smoothies with kefir. I mean, it's so easy to integrate into daily meals. And that's another good one to start off. I definitely think that starting off with something that uses wild fermentation, like sauerkraut or say kimchi, could be a little more accessible, just because you don't have to source a starter culture first. And, you know, if you're like going out of your way to purchase a starter culture, it could be a little frustrating if your first try doesn't go through. Whereas with sauerkraut, you can make small batches, test it out, you know, see how much salt you like. You know, you just kind of experiment with different herbs and spices and have fun with it. You know, it's a very creative process.
And if you want to do that, listener, this book, Fermentation on Wheels, by my guest Tara Whitsitt, is the perfect way to go. Thank you so much, Tara Whitsitt, for talking with us here on Writer's Voice. It's just a lovely book. We've just skimmed the surface of it, but it's been just great to talk with you about fermentation.
Thank you so much.
Tara Whitsitt. Go to writersvoice.net for links to fermentation recipes and to see photos of Whitsitt's bus. Next up, bone broth. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Back in 2016, we interviewed Catherine Harvey about the book she co-wrote with her husband, Ryan Harvey, The Bare Bones Broth Cookbook, 125 Gut-Friendly Recipes to Heal, Strengthen, and Nourish the Body. Here's an edited version of that interview. Bone broth is one of the newer foodie trends these days, but it used to be the way broth was just made, the days before you bought some dried bouillon cubes or packaged stock in the store. Back then, the stock pot was always simmering on the back of the stove with its rich collection of scraps, both animal and vegetable. When you simmer bones for many hours, and we're talking 24 hours in the case of beef and poultry bones, what you get at the end is something that deeply nourishes both body and soul. And it's not just for soup, as my guest Catherine Harvey shows in the book she co-wrote with her husband, Ryan Harvey, The Bare Bones Broth Cookbook, 125 Gut-Friendly Recipes to Heal, Strengthen, and Nourish the Body. In addition to soup, the book includes delicious recipes for main dishes and sides like chicken pot pie and carrot souffle. The Harveys say bone broth is great for our health, boosting immunity, aiding digestion, strengthening bones, and giving us better-looking skin, hair, and nails. And it could help us recover faster from injuries. Ryan and Catherine Harvey are the founders of the Bare Bones Broth Company, which sells artisanal bone broth to consumers online. Catherine Harvey, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. It's great to be here, Francesca.
Now, I found out about your book, The Bare Bones Broth Cookbook, because I actually had broken my ankle, and I was looking for ways to speed up the healing if possible, and I came upon the whole notion that making your own bone broth can actually help with wound healing.
Absolutely. A lot of doctors are telling us the same thing. It's largely because bone broth is loaded with collagen and glucosamine, which, as you probably know, are supplements that a lot of people take for joint health and for bone health.
So how did you find out about this? And then tell us, how did you come to decide to do a cookbook about this with your husband, Ryan?
Well, it really all starts with Ryan. He's a classically trained chef, and one of the first things that he learned in culinary school is the value of a high-quality stock in cooking, because it adds a lot of body and flavor to practically any dish that you can make. And he couldn't figure out why this kind of stock wasn't available to consumers in the supermarket, so he wanted to figure out a way to package it and sell it to them. Because most of the broths and stocks available in the store are made from a lot of sodium preservatives and MSG, and they don't have a lot of the ingredients and real food in them that a high quality stock does. So that's how he started making it, and he quickly realized, because he's kind of a nutrition buff, that stock made the homemade way is also really good for you. So we started doing a little bit of research into why that might be. I'm a journalist, so I'm a researcher by nature, and I helped him sort of dig into some of the studies that showed why this kind of broth and soup is good for people. And people have known this for centuries. We just lost touch with making real food the way they did 100 years ago. So this is basically just a return to real food, and we're finding that real food has a lot of nutritional benefit.
Yeah. In fact, yesterday I heard somebody on NPR, I believe it was, a doctor talking about how she's beginning to give prescriptions out for food, not supplements and not, I mean, for medicine as well, but also for food. So tell us more about this. Your subtitle is 125 Gut-Friendly Recipes to Heal, Strengthen, and Nourish the Body. Gut-friendly?
Gut-friendly, yeah. You mentioned that a lot of doctors are starting to recommend food and nutrition in lieu of supplements and medicine, and that's really because they're recognizing the importance of food in our mental health and in our gut health, which affects our mental health. And that's been a topic that's on the rise in a lot of news stories, how the health of the lining in our digestive tract affects every other part of our bodies, especially our mental health. Because what they have found is when we eat foods that aren't good for us, they damage the lining of our digestive tract, and they pierce or eventually wear away tiny holes in your digestive tract. So what happens is when you eat foods, even foods that would be good for you otherwise, with a damaged gut lining, some of those foods are absorbed into your bloodstream before they're processed. And in that form, a lot of times they're toxic to us. And when those toxins get into your bloodstream, they make their way to your brain. And they can affect your mental health. It can cause everything from depression to fuzzy thinking to just weariness, fatigue. So doctors have found that bone broth, because it contains a lot of the nutrients that rebuild our bodies from the cell up, they found that they also repair our gut lining. Those nutrients do. So it rebuilds your gut and repairs it from all of the damage we've done with the junk foods that our society is known for eating.
So, Catherine Harvey, is this also related to the idea of providing a good environment for your microbiome, for the gut-friendly bacteria?
Absolutely. It all starts with the health of your gut. You want to have healthy, secure linings in your digestive tract so that everything you consume is processed and absorbed properly. So it starts there. And then once you have a healthy gut lining, then you can start repairing your microbiome with probiotics and prebiotics, which I know a lot of people are hearing a lot about. So it's sort of a twofer. You've got to have that healthy gut lining, and then you've also got to have a healthy regimen of probiotics and prebiotics.
And so it's not just the gut, though, because you talk about hair and nails and joints. Talk a little bit about the health benefits of bone broth for those.
Well, if you look at the nutrients in bone broth, it's like reading the back of a multivitamin bottle. So it's just loaded with stuff that's good for you. It's got, like I mentioned, the glucosamine, the hyaluronic acid, chondroitin sulfate, tons of electrolytes, calcium, magnesium, phosphorus, silicon, and collagen, and tons of amino acids. And if you think about it, when you're making a bone broth, you're taking, in the case of Bare Bones, our bone broth company, we're taking the bones of healthy animals and we're simmering them for 24 hours. And in that simmer process, we are unlocking all of the nutrients from those bones. Those nutrients were the building blocks of life for the animal that those bones carried. And so we're unlocking those nutrients so they're in a bioavailable format for human consumption. So you're really transferring the building blocks of life from one being to another. And that sounds very spiritual, but that's really effectively what we're doing. And that's why those nutrients are so good for our bones and our skins and our joints and our hair, of course. So the nutrients just go to build the cells that make for a healthy human.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Catherine Harvey about the book she co-authored with her chef husband, The Bare Bones Broth Cookbook. Now, you mentioned 24 hours. Talk a little bit about the best way to make a bone broth and why so long, and how do you draw these nutrients out?
We start at 24 hours because that's the way that bone broth has been made traditionally for centuries. For a while, we were simmering the bones for up to 48 hours because we thought we could extract more nutrients from the bones that way. But what we found through testing is it really it didn't affect the amount of nutrients or the concentration of nutrients, simmering them at an additional 24 hours. So we simmer them for 24 hours because, as you know, bones are pretty dense, and you want to give them plenty of time to release the nutrients into the water, which is what you're starting with. You take these healthy animal bones, you cover them with water, and then you simmer gently for 24 hours. We try never to bring the broth to a boil because when you bring it to a boil, it emulsifies. A lot of times fat and other impurities will come out of the bones as well. So you don't want to emulsify those into the broth. You want to skim those off the top, which is why we do a gentle simmer. And then toward the end, we add vegetables and herbs to, they're essentially for flavor, but they can augment the nutritional benefits of the bone broth as well. And what you end up with after 24 hours is they call it Jewish penicillin. Your grandma probably recommended chicken soup for you when you were sick. So that's what you end up with. It's anti-inflammatory. It's nourishing. It is the very definition of a nutrient-dense food.
Now, you talked about toxins. So an awful lot of animals are raised with antibiotics and are, you know, raised in feedlots. Talk about the kind of animals. And, of course, this is a trigger warning for vegetarians.
Yeah, absolutely. This is why it's so important to start with very healthy animals who are raised properly. Because you are, anything that they ate or consumed, you're drawing out of the bones when you're simmering. So at Bare Bones, we use only grass-fed beef bones and pasture-raised organic chicken bones. This gives us the assurance that they weren't consuming antibiotics and growth hormones and all of the nasty things that have made their way into our food system. So it's really important that you start with healthy animals because those things that animals consume can cause them to be sick, which of course means that they could also cause us to be sick.
It can be pretty hard to find animals that are raised without antibiotics. I mean, for example, I go to my local chicken farm where the animals are free range, but I'm pretty sure they're not organic. Is it actually harmful to use them, or is it just not quite as good?
It can be. If you're consuming free range, you're probably in the clear. The reason it's hard to certify free range animals organic, and this is the same reason that our grass-fed beef bones are not certified organic. When the animals are roaming freely and eating what they want, it's really tough to verify that they're not eating something that was affected by GMO seed or some runoff from another farm. But usually those animals are consuming high quality organic food. It's just very hard to verify and confirm. So that's why the free range and sometimes pasture raised are not certified organic.
Hmm.
But usually they are organic.
So now there's another thing about simmering this for a long time. Something you talk about in the book that you want to get is the gelatin. So why gelatin and what are the best bones to simmer?
That's a great question. The gelatin, the reason that you want to achieve gelatin with your bone broth is that gelatin is the most visible indication of the quality of your bone broth. I've talked a couple of times about collagen, and collagen manifests itself in the physical world as gelatin. So if your broth gels, it's pretty certain that it's loaded with collagen. And collagen is the nutrient that most people are the most familiar with in bone broth. So a really gelatinous bone broth has tons of that collagen, which all of us need for our skin health and for our hair and our joints. And then you asked about, I'm sorry, I forgot the first part of your question.
The best kinds of bones, because I've actually noticed a difference. I mean, most of the time if you go to the supermarket and you ask for, you know, soup bones, they give you shank bones, and I haven't really gotten a whole lot of collagen from them. You know, I ended up having to get knuckle bones, which were much more difficult to find. But I do have to say that my local chicken farm will give you chicken feet for free, and boy, do they have a lot of collagen.
Oh, that's great. You're very fortunate that they're giving them to you for free, because the chicken feet really are the best part of the chicken for extracting that collagen. And this is Ryan's bailiwick. He figured out that the best bones to use, because it's a very popular opinion that you should use like marrow bones, the shank bones that you talked about, to make bone broth. But Ryan recognized early on that it's the bones that have tons of connective tissue that yield the most collagen and gelatin as a result. So we use those knuckle bones that you talked about for our beef broth. And for the chicken broth, we use chicken feet, and a lot of times we'll use the frames, the back, which has a lot of collagen in it as well. Mm-hmm. First of all, you don't have to simmer them as long to extract the nutrients, because you have those, all of the ligaments and the connective tissue, which are softer and easier to extract nutrients from. And second of all, they just have more of those nutrients. A lot of people will ask us about the, you know, do you use a lot of marrow in your broth? Well, not really, because that's not where the nutrients really are. If you want to consume marrow, just eat the marrow. But bone broth is, it's about using a part of the animal that you couldn't consume otherwise.
Well, this is a terrific book. Is there anything to watch out for before we go that, you know, a tip that maybe you didn't know when you started and that you discovered through the process?
The main tip, if somebody is going to be making bone broth at home, is just keep a close eye on it, because a 24-hour simmer is a long time, and we typically recommend that you simmer the broth uncovered, which means that the water you put over the bones initially is going to evaporate. So you have to keep an eye on things and keep adding water during the process as it sort of concentrates and reduces down. So that's the main tip. Just keep an eye on it. But there's no problem with leaving a pot of broth to simmer on the back of your stove. People've been doing it for hundreds of years. And I know a lot of people are a little nervous about that, but it really is perfectly safe as long as everything's covered with water.
And what about a slow cooker?
Slow cookers work fine, too. It's typically hard to find one that has a low enough setting to simmer the broth without it bubbling and emulsifying those fats and impurities back into the broth. But if you can find one that has a great low setting, then by all means, use it.
Well, Catherine Harvey, it's just been great to talk with you about your book, co-written with your husband, Ryan, The Bare Bones Broth Cookbook, 125 Gut-Friendly Recipes to Heal, Strengthen, and Nourish the Body. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Francesca.
Catherine Harvey of The Bare Bones Broth Company. To read an excerpt from The Bare Bones Broth Cookbook, go to writersvoice.net. Catherine Harvey. We spoke with her in 2016. Go to writersvoice.net to see recipes from The Bare Bones Broth Cookbook. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.